Our collective nightmare, a week of testimony, ended in Dedham with more things buried than explained. 24 witnesses walked the jury through parts of a life and a death. The state showed a trail of digital crumbs, trash pulled from a dumpster, and a man who has already admitted to lying and to tossing a body away, while still insisting he did not kill the woman he shared a bed with. Investigators played the phone like a scoreboard. Messages that never reached their target blinked across the record. The phone that might have answered never showed up. The texts read like someone trying to coax a ghost back. They were never delivered. The phone's silence became evidence. A dumpster yielded tools, a hacksaw, a hatchet, a hammer. They were treated to the courtroom like props in a grotesque theater. The medical examiner tested those tools for tissue. He will go back on the stand. The state is trying to prove the things we throw away are not always private. The defense spent hours picking at the edges. The attorney argued the investigation was narrow, that the window examined was small, that the phone history shown was a chosen slice. The defense asked the jury to look at the rest, at recipes, restaurant searches, the humdrum of life, as if ordinariness is a get-out-of-guilt card. The defense also offered the version that feels both obvious and unbearable. A man found his wife dead, panicked, lied, and then tried to hide what he did out of fear of not being believed. That is a story that requires no invention. It only needs a world willing to believe panic over murder. A controversial name surfaced. A trooper once dismissed for misconduct was tied to the early phase of the investigation. The judge stopped that line of questioning for now. Misconduct hangs over the case like a stain that can't be scrubbed out on paper alone. Prosecutors must show planning to reach first-degree murder. The defense says there was no plan. The jury will be asked to decide which version fits the facts. The judge suggested the jury could get the case after another 2 weeks of testimony. 2 weeks to sort through phone ghosts, dumpster tools, and the messy human things people refuse to call by name. There will be more witnesses. The woman's boss, who last saw her before she disappeared, is expected to testify. More investigators will explain the steps that led to an arrest. There is also the quiet and unanswerable possibility that the defendant will take the stand. He has room for one more story. The legal machinery grinds on. Evidence is cataloged, motives argued, narratives assembled. Life without parole hangs over a man who admitted to hiding a body and lying to police but denies taking the life that created 3 children. The country watches, not because it hopes for justice, but because it has grown used to watching small public tragedies recycled into courtroom sport. This is a trial that asks the usual questions and refuses the easy ones. It asks whether a pile of digital records and a dumpster full of metal can fill the gap between what we know and what we will admit to. The answer will come from a jury, from an exhausted system, and from a public that keeps expecting better and keeps getting something we can only name as tired cruelty.
The World Cup groups are out, and nothing says global unity like 32 countries being politely arranged into 12 tiny bureaucratic panic attacks. We have co-hosts Mexico, Canada, and the United States, which means the tournament is both geographically convenient and emotionally inconvenient. Fans in Europe are thrilled because now they can watch a game at the crack of dawn and complain about the lack of atmosphere on social media before their commute. Fans in small countries are thrilled too, mostly because for the next month, their national colors will be pinned to every profile picture while the rest of the world scrolls past climate crises and mutters, "Incredible, what a story." There's Spain, shortlisted for pre-tournament favorite, which translates to, "We've already booked a flight and a therapist." There's Brazil in Group C, Morocco waiting like the polite friend who shows up unexpectedly and wins everything, and then there's Haiti in the same group, which makes the FIFA draw feel like a geography pop quiz with feelings. And of course, Cristiano Ronaldo and Lionel Messi might be making their last World Cup appearances, which means entire countries will be emotionally prepared to sob into overpriced stadium scarves while also arguing about VAR decisions for 90 minutes afterward. We will treat these aging legends like endangered species. Observe quietly, do not make sudden movements, and please don't ask them to explain Instagram. The draw also brought us placeholders. Winner of European Playoff B. That's bureaucratic suspense, like being on hold with customer service while music tells you everything will be fine. Fans will spend the next week inventing backstories for these phantom teams, picking their fantasy heroes from outlines and national anthems they've never heard. First world logic. We get upset about uncertainty when the uncertainty is merely about which millionaire will disappoint us. Then there are the travel logistics nobody asked for, but everybody will obsess over. New Zealand in Group G, Great, now prepare for a fan base philosophically committed to jet lag. Curaçao, Cape Verde, Jordan, Uzbekistan. Countries you could no longer find on a tourist brochure now determine whether your group stage bar stream deserves your loyalty. The biggest emotional investment isn't in the players. It's in whether your streaming package, your VPN, and your employer's flexible working policy will align to let you watch Uzbekistan versus Portugal at 2:30 a.m. local time. That's our era's sacrifice. We will argue about the group of death like it's the moral equivalent of choosing between coffee roasters. We will simulate bracket doom, call for managerial heads, and start petitions to move games to more favorable time zones. Because nothing says solidarity like an overnight petition. Meanwhile, countries with real problems show up in the draw as if football were a temporary distraction. We will tweet proud and then return to our algorithms, treating the miracle of representation as a weekend entertainment option. The irony is delicious. Worldwide desperation and extraordinary resilience reduced to whether our group requires an extra alarm. At the end of the day, the biggest tragedy of the World Cup draw won't be a missed penalty. It will be the human capacity to panic about which match to watch while the planet refuses to cooperate with our viewing schedules. We are absolutely, passionately, heroically preoccupied with deciding which overpriced jersey to storm the supermarket in. And when the whistle blows, we will weep for a legend and complain about the Wi-Fi. That is the modern miracle: global passion, local inconvenience, and the everlasting belief that the real problem is whether our snacks will stay cold during extra time.
They passed a law called the Epstein Files Transparency Act, and then argued that passing a law counts as doing something about the rot. A federal judge in Florida dutifully agreed that the statute overrules Rule 6E, the old velvet curtain that kept grand jury secrets from the light. The curtain will now be yanked aside, not because anyone suddenly cares more about justice, but because disclosure has become the preferred drama. The Justice Department has asked two judges in New York to follow suit. In Florida, the judge didn't demand that the DOJ even inventory what will be opened. In plain terms, the file cabinet can be dumped, and the public can sort through what remains of privacy and decency. The protective order that might be modified covers everything you'd rather not see made public. Flight logs, travel records, search warrants, police reports, booking photos, estate, materials, and, most damningly, notes and reports from interviews with victims. A lawyer for hundreds of survivors begged the court to force the DOJ to protect identities if records are unsealed. That plea arrived after an earlier congressional document dump exposed numerous survivors, names 20,000 pages of broken promises, apparently the standard operating procedure for transparency in the modern state. Congress promised protection. Congress also provided the leak. The Florida investigation ended in 2007 with a non-prosecution agreement. Epstein pleaded to a state charge, and federal charges vanished like inconvenient paperwork. The newly freed transcripts may explain how that happened, or they may simply give the public another grim feed to scroll past. Either way, the optics of unsealing already feel performative, a ritual that looks like accountability while the machinery that enabled abuse keeps humming. This is the version of openness we've perfected. Pass a law to reveal secrets, fail to guarantee safety, and then lean back while the spectacle of disclosure does the work of appearing to fix what won't be fixed. The documents might shock, they might indict, they might re-expose survivors, and leave the old bargains intact. Whatever happens, the country has illustrated its new motto: transparency without protection, publicity without justice. Welcome to the transparency era, where unsealing is entertainment, not repair.
The capitalist's fever dream. A decade and a half after a studio boss laughed at a scrappy streamer as if it were a mosquito, the mosquito bought the ranch. Netflix's $72 billion swing for the Warner half. The part with HBO's prestige, franchise catalogs, and movie library reads less like a business move and more like a purge. One fewer owner, one bigger gatekeeper, one more place for your eyeballs to be rented. Warner Brothers Discovery carves itself in two and hands the shiny, sellable half to a company that promises more high-quality titles, while the other half, Discovery Global, with CNN and reruns of nature shows, gets spun off like a dividend. Content becomes an asset class. Journalism is boxed into a tradable subsidiary. Everything that once defined culture is reduced to ledger entries and antitrust talking points. Regulators will chew on this for months, maybe years. That spectacle is part of the carnival. Hearings, anonymous leaks about heavy skepticism, threats of lawsuits, the usual arm wrestle between lawyers and lobbyists. The Trump administration, now back in the driver's seat, can make that slog political, using skeptics and loyalists interchangeably to slow or reshape outcomes. It can cajole a judge, posture on cable, whisper to bidders. It cannot simply stop the machine, but it can make the machine noisier, stranger, and more expensive for everyone. Netflix will sell the merger as survivalism. We're not the Goliath. Look, Google and Amazon are bigger. It will promise fresh opportunities for creators, even as studios clip the wings of independent producers and bundle legacy catalogs into subscription tiers. Paramount chewed on the carcass too, flirting with hostile moves and old relationships in Washington. Comcast circled. The auction played out like a boardroom gladiator fight, with the public paying the tab in monthly fees and cultural consolidation. The HBO Max sign is likely to be folded under Netflix's roof. Another brand swallowed, another login erased. Consumers will face higher prices, thinner choices, masked as more content. Regulators may wring their hands. Executives will posture about competition from YouTube. The creative community will be promised new money, even as budgets tighten. Middle-class writers and technicians slowly disappear into fewer contracts and shorter runs. Every line in this deal is a symptom. The privatization of culture, the weaponization of regulatory review, the political theater that serves corporate chess moves, the hollow promise that consolidation buys better art. The fever dream is not that a streamer bought a studio. The fever dream is that we applauded while it happened, paid for it, and then subscribed again.